Today's Peisho is on case 67 in the Book of Serenity. Case 67 is entitled The Flower Ornament Scriptures Wisdom. Introduction. One atom contains myriad forms. One thought includes a billion years. What about a powerful person who wears the sky on his head and stands on the ground? A spiritually sharp fellow who knows the tale when the head is spoken of. Doesn't he turn his back on his own spirit and bury away the family treasure? Case, the flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. Verse, sky covers, earth bears, making a mass, making a clump, pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles with no inside, getting to the end of the mysterious subtlety. Who distinguishes turning towards and turning away? Buddhas and patriarchs come to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nan Chan. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. Doing such an outstanding job this morning in the Zendo, a really deep city. This koan, it references one of the most important Mahayana sutras, the Flower Ornament Sutra. And the Flower Ornament Sutra is had a major effect on the Hua Yan Sutra, had a major effect on Chinese Buddhism. The sutra was composed in India, but it had a major impact on Chinese Buddhism and a very big influence on Zen. So this is a sutra that probably most monks and nuns practicing in olden times would have been familiar with, even though it's 1,500 pages long. So you can plan on spending a couple years reading it if you're really determined. And it's a treat. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. So hopefully we'll all have the chance to read that sutra at some point. The koan here is pretty brief. It says, the Flower Ornament Sutra says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So, you know, the interesting thing is that what it says, the sutra says, is something, it's really like a commonplace idea. Of course, we Zen people know, we believe that all living beings have Buddha nature, and that because, of their obstacles, because of their false conceptions and attachments, they did not realize it. But beware, right? Beware. Because, you know, koans sometimes say things that sound like they're simple, straightforward teachings. So there's a koan that says, what is the way? And the teacher says, your ordinary mind is the way. So, you know, thousands of people read that koan in the English-speaking world, and Joshu asks Nansen, what is the way? And Nansen says, your ordinary mind is the way. And people read that koan and think, well, that's obvious. Yes, you know, that's the meaning of that is obvious. But actually, it's not obvious, right? We would agree to that, but the koan's actually trying to call that into question. So, you know, every koan has a kind of hook or a hidden hook. It's like you're a fish swimming along in the water and what goes by but a beautiful insect.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, oh, just what I was thinking I would eat for lunch, you know, and then you bite into it and you get reeled into somebody's boat, right? So this is the same way, right? This is the koans always have a hook. So beware, especially if it seems to be saying something that we all believe is true. So this koan is like the ordinary mind koan. It's saying something obvious, but it's not. But beware, because it's not what we think. It doesn't mean what we think it means. So the Flower Ornament Sutra is 1,500 pages long, and it's a presentation of Buddha's teaching. And you could say that it takes this. Most Buddhist sutras include, at least in part, a story, right? And it usually has to do with the Buddha being asked to teach, and then the Buddha presents it, his teaching, and everybody hears the teaching and they're enlightened. And some of us in the Sutra Study Group have been reading the Sharangama Sutra, which is this incredibly complicated, very difficult sutra, right? But even the Sharangama Sutra has a story, right? And the story is basically people are unenlightened, and they hear the Buddha speak. And when they hear the Buddha speak, it clears everything up and they become enlightened. That's the story. You know, and that's basically the story that all Buddhists accept, right? We all accept that story. So unenlightened, receive teaching or receive insight, enlightened. You know, unenlightened, insight, enlightened. See, it's just like that. And in fact, you know, the story of the Buddha himself follows that pattern. So, I think everybody in this room is familiar with the basic outlines of the Buddha's story. You know, the Buddha was born in northeastern India. He, according to legend, his father was a prince, but actually his father was probably like the Speaker of the House of the Parliament, right? You know. Eventually, the Buddha's country was wiped off the map, and the parliament building where his father worked was destroyed, and people forgot all about representative government. You know, basically, you had kings. So when they told about the Buddha's past, they said his father was a king. But actually, you know, the place where the Buddha was from, called the Shakya Republic, was a representative democracy, pretty sophisticated place, and his father was probably the Speaker of the House of the Parliament. In fact, in the Pali Sutras, it tells us that the Buddha was invited to speak at the Parliament of the Shakya Republic. And he was quite old, and he was giving a speech, and he said, "I wonder if you would mind if I lean against this pillar, because my back is hurting me." So look, even the Buddha's legs hurt, even the Buddha's back got tired. So he gave this speech at the House of Parliament in the Shakya Republic. So anyway, the legend is that the Buddha was the son of a prince. And, you know, his father wanted him not to see the realities of life. He wanted him to stay in the palace and inherit the kingdom, right? That's the legend. And yet one day the Buddha saw a person who was sick, and he had never seen sickness according to the legend. And he said, "What is this? What is this? And, you know, this person is dying of whatever, you know, smallpox or something like that." And then the Buddha saw somebody who was old, and according to the legend, his father had contrived so that he never saw any old people. And then he saw a corpse. And this so shattered him that he left his young son and wife and went out into the world of wandering ascetics trying to find enlightenment. And after many hardships, you know, the Buddha almost died. He had tried fasting his way to enlightenment, and that didn't work. And he left his five companions who were still fasting, and he went into the village, and a village girl who was moved by the sight of this miserable person, bare-boned, dirty, you know, and so on, made him a meal of rice and milk. And he ate it and renewed his strength and went back to his cushion and started sitting through the night. And he was tempted by Mara, the tempter, by the Buddhist equivalent of the devil. And he overcame all these temptations, and in the morning he saw the morning star. And when he saw the morning star, he had his daikensho. And then, according to the story, the Buddha decided that what had happened to him was so amazing and unlike anything people assumed to be true, that nobody would understand him if he tried to communicate. So he was really ready to just live the life of a wandering ascetic and treasure his insight. But a deity appeared before him, a little god named Sahampati. And Sahampati said, "Oh, please don't do that." He said, if you, having had this insight into reality, if you who have had the supreme awakening without remainder, if you turn your back on humanity, all is lost. But if you try to help, there will be people who understand your teaching and follow your way." So the Buddha decided to do that. And for the next, you know, basically 45 years of his life, he day in and day out, without a break, he taught the Dharma. So that's the story, right? That's the story that's come down to us. And, you know, when we go to Sesshin, that's what we expect will happen, right? That's what we expect, you know. You know, the idea is that we're coming to Sesshin, we're unenlightened, and we'll have a breakthrough experience, and then we'll be enlightened. And that's what it's all about. You know, and I myself really thought that way very much when I started practicing Zen. You know, I had read all of these books about Buddhism, and some of them were quite wrong, right? Some of them were really like totally unreliable sources. So I remember I was a big fan of a writer whose name was Lobsang Rampa. Lobsang Rampa is not really a Tibetan. His name, notwithstanding, was really European. Who wrote these fantastic accounts of Tibet that are totally made up. So, you know, this Lobsang Rampa said that the Tibetans can communicate telepathically, right? And he also said that in Tibet they actually fly from one place to another on kites, like giant kites. So it's just all made up, and this was wildly popular. This stuff In the 1920s and 30s, these books were like bestsellers, right? Because nobody knew anything about it. And I read these books myself, and I just thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You know, telepathy, you know, it's all true, you know. So, you know, when I had also read reliable sources on Buddhism, but they were all mixed up in my mind. And you know, when I started practicing Zen with Genki Roshi, you know, I really had this, I remember I just started practicing Zen. And I was in the High Spot Cafe in Seattle. If you know anything about the High Spot Cafe, it's a great place to have like an omelet and a cup of coffee on a Saturday morning. And I was there with some friends of mine, and I said, yeah, I started practicing Zen, you know. And one of my friends, you know, said, well, you know, do you think you'll achieve enlightenment? And I said, oh yes, you know, I'm sure. I really, I mean, I said that. And I said, you know, I imagine it'll take you a couple of years, you know. So, you know, I had no idea what I was getting into, right? And it certainly took more than a couple of years to begin to make some real progress along the path. I had this idea, right? I had no concrete understanding of what Zen practice actually involved. But I had, you know, read these books, and I had read even like koan exchanges. You know, so you know, it'll say something like Jojo Za is you know, at, it's called up to the front of the room, and Linji says, "Jojo Za, why don't you bow?" And Jojo Za bows, and Linji hits him, you know, Jojo Za, he hits him, and then somebody says, "Why don't you bow?" And he bows, and he has this great enlightenment experience. Or, you know, a teacher will shove a student out the window, and he'll have an enlightenment experience. Or Joshu will put his sandals on his head and walk out the room backwards, you know, enlightenment experience, you know. So this literature of Zen is all about, like, people having these dramatic experiences, you know. And you know, I got into Zen because this is a very appealing set of stories, right? Really appealing. So, you know, I went to my first sesshin, and I really thought, you know, who knows, you know, I may achieve enlightenment this sesshin. And you know, nothing went the way I imagined it in my mind. So, you know, I thought I would go to sesshin, and really, I honestly thought that when they said Dokusan, I would go in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan, and Genki Roshi would say something like, "Look, hold this image in your mind, you know, and when the light comes shining through, you know, embrace it," or something like that. And, you know, I really thought he'd give me, like, secret instructions, because actually in Buddhism there is a whole tradition of Buddhist, especially in Tantric tradition from Tibet, is esoteric, you know, there's the exoteric Buddhism, that's the one you read about in the books, but there's the esoteric Buddhism, right? And I remember reading this woman who's totally on the level, Alexandra David Nayal, who went to Tibet and became a lama. She did experience complete enlightenment. She was really quite an amazing person, real, and wrote books that are really excellent books, but it was, in my mind, it was all mixed up with all the junk I'd read. So she talked about receiving, like, secret teachings from the lamas she studied with in Tibet. So when I went into Dogasan, I thought, you know, I had this idea that it was going to be like secret teachings, you know. And so, you know, I went to my first sesshin thinking, you know, a couple of years, I'm sure to be awakened. And nothing at the sesshin went the way I expected it to go, you know. I mentioned earlier in the week that, you know, I had done some meditation before I started my first sesshin, but, you know, I had not meditated more than, say, half an hour, maybe an hour at the most. And when I started, you know, sitting with the Seattle Zen Center, you know, sitting three periods of like 25 to 30 minutes was a real strain. And then when I went to sesshin, you know, I had, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, our first sesshin, Genki Roshi had just come from Japan, and he thought we were much more adept than we were. So he was going to run the sesshin just like a sesshin at Ryotakuji. He said 45-minute sitting periods. And, you know, many people in our group were much more experienced than I, and they were crying out by midday of the first day. Because, you know, that's a long sits. We do that here. Many of us can sit for an hour and a half, but you know, 35 minutes was sort of everybody's limit. And it was about 15 minutes beyond my limit, you know. So, you know, by the end of the first day, I was thinking, you know, what have I done? What have I gotten into? And fortunately for me, the Sesshin was on an island, you know, actually. And I had driven with a group of other people in their car, so there was no escape, right, you know. So I had to stick it out, I guess. And I didn't want to leave, right? Something kept me there. But I remember just everything went wrong, right? It was just like by the end of the second day, I would go to the bunkhouse at the end of the day, and it was just like it felt like every muscle in my body hurt. And you know, there's a cliche, and they'll say your teeth were chattering, right? His teeth were chattering. But actually, my teeth were chattering. You know, I had never had that experience before. I would go to bed, and it was like my teeth were like literally chattering. I had so much pain, right? And you know, and when I went in to see Genki Roshi, you know, I sort of crawled into the Dokusan room and on my hands and knees, and I couldn't possibly sit on the cushion the way I was supposed to sit with my legs under my bottom, you know, with the seiza posture, you know, which is the formal posture for Dokusan. I could just barely sit on the cushion at all, you know, and he could see my suffering, and he was very, very kind and encouraging. But, you know, it wasn't the secret initiation I expected. And you know, my Zen career kind of took that trajectory, not just the first sesshin, but, you know, many sesshins after that. You know, so the story in my mind was, you know, unenlightened, go to sesshin, have an insight, and then, you know, enlightenment, you know, totally enlightened. And that never happened. It never happened, you know. I kept going to sesshin and not having necessarily even an insight, right? And sort of blindly going along. And you know, I've mentioned this many times, but, you know, when Genki Roshi came to Seattle, it was 1977, 76. And I think the average age in Seattle was like 33 years old or something. You know, it was a very young town. Lots of people were, this was a different time, you know. You could rent an apartment for $80 a month. So your money was not a problem for a lot of people. You could work one job and have your own apartment. You know, it was unheard of, not like now. So you had all these young people, they weren't in any economic pain. And there was a lot of interest in, you know, Eastern traditions, meditation, Buddhism, and this very respected Zen master came. So suddenly, you know, sitting at the Wednesday nights, you'd have 40 people there to study with Genki Roshi, and we would have sesshins where, you know, basically 30 people would come to sesshin. It was just this big group, and you know, we all sort of like you know, college. You go to college and you're the class of something. We were all like the class of 1977, and we all started practicing together. And you know, everybody seemed to be passing their koans but me, you know. Genki Roshi gave me the breath perception koan. And in my mind, you know, I would go sit down on the cushion and I would have an insight. And it would be something, you know, amazing, really special, big. And I'd go to Genki Roshi and I'd say, blah, 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 and he'd go, ah, you know, you're the reincarnation of my old teacher. Yeah. Yeah. I knew I would find you. You know, around that time, there was a movie called Little Buddha. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it was by Bernardo Bertolucci, and it was about a little boy in Seattle who's discovered as a reincarnated lama. You know, so I thought maybe Genki would discover me as a reincarnated Zen master or something like that. You know, I mean, we all have fantasies, right? We all do. Or at least I think we do. So, you know, anyway, in my fantasy, that was going to happen. But in reality, that's not what happened, right? You know, in reality, what happened was he said, watch your breath. And he actually said it like this. The breath with eyes, where does it go? Tell me. So I sat down on my cushion and I was so disappointed. I thought, you know, why doesn't he give me the secrets? Why doesn't he give me the big things, the big, you know, reincarnation and so on? And instead he's saying, watch your breath. It was like this is like a baby koan, right? Give me something real, right? And I would watch my going to see him and I'd say, the breath goes in and the breath goes out. And he, no. And then I'd say, I just tried different things. I wrote poetry. I brought in flowers. I thought it was about being creative. You know, and I also would go outside and I'd think, you know, what am I supposed to see? What am I supposed to see? And I'd look and look, you know. But I wasn't looking at my breath. You know, I was looking for something special, not the breath. The breath is ordinary. And basically, it was only many years later that I began to realize how extraordinary the breath really is. You know, I wasn't ready to be lost. You know, I wasn't ready to be lost. I wanted the story to fit. I wanted to fit the story. Right? You know, there's a wonderful writer, I don't know if you've ever heard of her, her name is Joan Didion. She's an essayist and a novelist who died just a few years ago. And she has this very famous sentence. She says, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And you know, people think she's speaking positively about stories, but she's not. She's saying we tell ourselves stories in order to live, but they're not true. They're not true. Stories are not true. No story is true. See, that's what she's really saying. So we tell ourselves stories, but life never fits the story. You know, and this is so important because in my mind I was telling myself a story about myself, and the life I was living was deviating from the story. And I felt terrible about it, you know. I thought, I've got to do something. You know, I've got to come up with some answer to this breath koan. And I couldn't tolerate being lost or being outside of a story to protect me from my uncertainty. So I kept trying to recover the story. And, you know, years later, you know, I was watching my breath. You know, after the Roshi had sort of passed me on the breath koan and moved me to the mu koan, I was watching my breath and I realized, you know, that's the strangest thing. You know, my breath, when I really watch it, doesn't seem to be going out my nose. It seems to be going out my forehead. You know, that's the strangest thing. And if I had gone into the teacher and I had said to Genki Roshi like 4 years earlier when I was working with the breath perception koan, my breath goes out my forehead, he would have passed me in a minute. He said, excellent. Or if when you watch your breath, sometimes the breath completely disappears and you actually wind up in emptiness. Right? So if you watch your breath, you keep following the breath, that everything disappears after a while. If I had gone into Genki Roshi and said, you know, the darndest thing happened to me. I was watching my breath and my mind went completely blank and everything seemed to disappear. He probably would have given me a hug. You know, but I wasn't ready to be lost. You know, I wanted the story to fit. I wanted my life to be like the story of Siddhartha or these great Zen masters. And so I couldn't be intelligent. I couldn't be not intellectually intelligent, but I couldn't be awake or alert to what was really happening. because I kept looking at the story instead of what was really happening. And when I was, you know, I was working on this breath perception koan, we would all go to sesshin, and basically, I would see people coming out of the Dokusan room, you know, with a big smile. You know, people would be coming out of the Dokusan room, and I'd be sitting on the cushion, and I'd look up, and I'd see this big smile on their face, like, I just answered my koan, you know. And you're never supposed to discuss your koan with others, you know, but sometimes I would hear people say, although we'd be driving home together in the car, and people would say, oh, I passed my koan. And somebody says, me too! You know, and I'd be sitting there thinking, oh my God, I haven't passed, it's been like 2 years and I haven't passed the baby koan. And of course, you know, I began to feel like a failure. You know, the more this went on, the worse I felt about myself and my practice, right? I mean, I thought answering your koans was like being good on a test, right? So I was a good test taker in high school. So I thought, you know, if I should be able to crack the books and get the answer to this koan. But I couldn't do it. And, you know, so all these people would come back from sesshin and they would feel elated because they had a breakthrough, and I just thought, what do they got that I haven't got? You know, what is it that, you know, I got really, I didn't quit. Because basically when I did Zazen, for reasons I didn't understand, I felt so good afterwards. But I had to sort of swallow this failure, you know, my constant failure to fit the story, right? And these other people were sort of fitting the story. So a lot of Zen practice is about, you know, realizing that the story is never true. It's never true. And that when you begin to deviate from the story, you're starting to encounter reality. You're starting to encounter reality. So you know, when we get a koan, your teacher gives you a koan and you read the koan, it might make perfect sense. So beware, because you know that's not the answer, right? It's not the answer. If you can explain, the koan in terms of like, well, here's the point, right? It's, you know, we should be patient, or, you know, we should always look for the good in others, you know. Those are nice sentiments, but theirs are just stories. You know, when you begin to practice deeply with the koan, you have to go into real uncertainty. You know, you sit there and you don't know what the hell you're supposed to do next. And this is probably where some of you are right now with your koans. And added to that, you may also have, you know, another story we tell is that I came, you know, I've been practicing faithfully, you know, I sit every day. I knew I would come to sesshin and I would have no pain in my legs. But now you've done all the above and you still have pain in your legs. So it's deviating from the story again. And when things deviate from the story, we feel guilty, right? We often feel guilty. We feel cheated, like this is a scam, you know. I remember one time working on a koan and when I came up with the answer and presented it to the Roshi, I was hopping mad because it wasn't the answer I wanted to give. It was a different answer. It wasn't what that didn't fit the story. And I actually came out of that Zendo like steamed. I was really mad. I felt like this Zen is a scam. You know, this is a scam. I'm going to write an article and expose Zen, you know, to the whole world. But you know, what happens if you go through this process enough times is you realize that when the story fails, when it does it, when you're not conforming to the story, you're like in unknown territory. And then, you know, a deeper intelligence begins to kick in. This deeper intelligence, deeper awareness. It's like we stop trying to make things fit the story, and we activate our, we say in Zen, our Buddha nature, our Buddha mind. Right? And now we begin processing in a different way, right? So instead of trying to make things fit what we already know, we're allowing the koan to take us to places that we don't know, and we don't even know where we're going. And you know, the koan is actually leading us on a journey of discovery, and we just have to follow it. We just have to trust it. And that's very hard because, of course, we like to control the situation. It's like if somebody just pulled up and said, "Hop in the car," you might say, "Where are you going?" Right? You said, "Well, we don't know." You might be unwilling to get in that car, but that's what your big mind is saying to you. You know, please get in. And you know, when we're in enough discouragement and discomfort, we may actually get in. And then, you know, the koan is going to take us on a journey. And often it's a journey through things that we haven't, sometimes at least, it's a journey through things we haven't allowed ourselves to see because they didn't fit the story, right? You know? And yet, you know, there they come. You know, and when they come up, we buried them somewhere, maybe not intentionally, right? Not intentionally, but you know, we sort things out. You know, when something happens that fits the story, we say that's a keeper. And when something happens that doesn't fit the story, we'll say that's nonsense, or this is not relevant, right? Or, you know, we're ashamed, or we're, you know, we hide it from ourselves, we hide it from others. It's like when my parents got divorced, my mother didn't want me to tell my friends. It's like, "Mother, I think they'll notice you and Dad aren't in the same house anymore, you know. And he's dating somebody else," right? So, but you know, that since we're departing from the story, people are supposed to get married and they're supposed to be together for 50 years, right? And now, you know, 17 years into my mother's and father's marriage, it was falling apart. My mother was ashamed that she was departing from the story. And so we all experience that, right? And so you repress, right? You push that away, push that out of sight. But that makes us unintelligent. Sticking to the story makes us unintelligent, right? When we begin to let the big mind lead us, it's like whole sections of our life that we have buried alive come back to life and are present for us. And all of these things contribute to making our world more whole and alive. But we have to be willing to be in uncertainty. You know, in Zen this is called not knowing, not knowing. And so, you know, today is, for some of you, day two of Sesshin, you know, and you may be in a real state of not knowing right now, you know, and it's compounded by many things, not just the loss of, you know, the loss of certainty and, you know, loss of mental clarity, but, you know, physical discomfort too, right? All of those things make us, you know, close up. But you know, if we go with the koan, if we let it, that mysterious stranger take us, you know, the mysterious stranger is going to take us to this wonderful place. Along the way, some things that might be a little scary are going to come up, or things that we didn't value properly, you know, things that we didn't appreciate at the time. But when we go to that place, you know, all these things that were forgotten or lost are rediscovered and integrated into our lives. And, you know, we come out on the other side much more fully alive. So, you know, to practice the path is constantly entering in uncertainty, right? That's, and what you find is you go into uncertainty, and then it's like what looks like chaos assembles itself It's like suddenly there's, you know what to say or you know what to do. And if you haven't gone through this process yet, please believe me. You know, it's like suddenly you just know what to do. You know what to say. And, you know, basically it's like you, through no effort, on, with no effort on your own part, through no, through nothing you have done, you know, it's like all of these fragments assemble themselves into this coherent world for you, right? And this is the world of Zen. We go into this sort of unknowing, fragmented state, and then it all comes back together in this beautiful way. And the world's a little bigger, and then we go into that unknowing, fragmented state again, and then the world assembles itself. It's like magic. It's really beautiful. And the more this happens, the more you trust the process. The flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened one. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So there's the story. And what's to know? I already knew that. But if you work with the koan, you begin to see that there's something behind that story, behind what we know. Verse, sky covers, earth bears, making a mass, making a clump, pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles with no inside, getting to the end of the mysterious subtlety. Who distinguishes turning towards and turning away? Buddhas and ancestors come to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nansen. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. So we all have to find our own truth, you know, by following our true nature. Nobody can find it for us, but it's there.